It is Saturday, August 11th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, following the week in geek news, we are talking about data centers. The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. On this episode of Geek Speak, we're covering some interesting geek-related news stories, and we have a special guest to help us dive into the world of data centers. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go right now, go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us, and I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Cruise.io, providing local internet services including DSL, computer care, classes, and website builders. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks. Let's see, whose mic is... Miles, your mic is messy. Let's see if we can swap.
Your mic is messy?
It's just not sounding good, man. Go ahead and switch to mic 5. Okay, so Miles is going to be on in just a second. We also have... That's Miles Elam, slacker and student. We also have Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Hi, Sean.
Good morning.
And we have Ryder Brooks, Support Engineer at Sun Microsystems.
Hi, good morning.
And in just a moment, we'll have Drew Meyer as well joining us. And
I need
Miles
coffee.
You need coffee? You haven't had
Unfortunately,
coffee?
Unfortunately, Alex is making some right now.
Oh, but Alex is at home.
In L.A.
Well, yeah, in Orange County.
Orange County, yeah.
And Miles is working on his mic. So while that's happening, Sean, let's start with the news with you, sir.
Well, this is kind of interesting. A blogger found a Y2K bug in NASA climate data, according to DailyTech.com. So this guy, his name is Steve McIntyre, operates a site called climateaudit.org. And he was inspecting historical temperature graphs and noticed a strange discontinuity a jump. Well, the two guys at NASA who actually put the data together used an algorithm to determine, you know, the heat, you know, with all this data that they had. Mm-hmm. And this algorithm, they would not give it out.
So it wasn't open source.
It was not. So Steve McIntyre, he actually reverse engineered the algorithm that was used to create the data, uh-huh. and in so doing found the Y2K bug. Interesting data came out after this. NASA actually released corrected figures, and 1998 is no longer the warmest year on record.
Oh.
It's actually 1934.
Oh, really? What is this? Does this modify a lot of the claims of global warming, or is it just a small part of the
story? We still have global warming issues. It's just not as bad, maybe, as people thought it was, but it's still bad, I'm sure. I mean, I'm not going to make any statements here. I really don't know.
All right. But it is interesting that a large scientific study was affected by a Y2K bug.
Yeah. 7 years afterwards. It took 7 years to figure it out.
Yeah.
This is such a big thing. 1921 takes the third record. In fact, 5 of the 10 warmest years on record now all occur before World War II.
Very interesting. All right. Well, thank you very much, Sean, for that story.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Hi, Ryder.
Hi.
How you doing today?
Pretty good.
What's your news story, sir?
So today in the world of big companies probably going down, SCO is who I used to work for. Looks like I got out just in time. They had a court case with Novell that was to discuss the copyright ownership of Unix and Unixware, which was really critical to their IBM lawsuit that's been going on for a while.
It is basically the copyright of Unix, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so SCO, which used to be Santa Cruz Operations but hasn't been for a long time,
yeah.
A Unix creator, made a really stable, secure version of Unix, has been suing companies that have been using the term Unix, saying that they own the copyright. And the Novell lawsuit, why specifically have they been targeting Novell over the years?
Well, Novell's actually targeted them. They had a lawsuit against IBM for basically violating their what SCO believed to be their copyright.
Guys, it's not copyright. It's a licensing agreement. The copyright for Unix is owned by the Open Group, which is a separate entity entirely. So the discussion is, does IBM have a license through Novell, or does SCO have a license through Novell to use the code that's included in some of their Unix versions?
Oh, specifically, this news story that we read yesterday was really specifically about a copyright issue.
Oh. Yeah.
But maybe it's the copyright code, not
maybe
the
trademark.
Unix trademark.
Yeah, not the trademark.
Okay.
It's of
code
the actual intellectual property,
okay,
the code.
Thank you.
Yeah, that is correct. The term,
that's how you actually do
the
protect.
Term Unix is owned by the Open Group.
Right, so that's how you protect the copyright of the code. I mean, the only way you protect code is by copyright.
Yeah, it's actual code.
So, Miles, you're on line five. Are you there?
I hate the term intellectual property. I really do.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. You get bantered about it.
Taking copyright, patent, and trademark, three completely different.
And putting them all into one umbrella?
Yeah, completely different entities and putting them all into one item and mixing them in people's heads.
So Novell is suing. It says sued SCO, and what's the outcome?
Well, the outcome is basically that Novell won the suit. I'm sure it will probably get appealed by SCO, or SCO, excuse me. It's not SCO anymore. But the judge ruled that they do indeed did not transfer the Unix copyrights to SCO when they sold them Unixware back in, I believe, in the early 90s.
Uh-huh.
Which was the kingpin for their lawsuit against IBM.
Is it still possible? I mean, the article that I'd read yesterday really was clear that this is kind of the nail in the coffin. It's over at this point. But you're saying that it's possible another one of these, they could try to appeal this case.
Yeah, I mean, you can always appeal.
Right. Okay, yeah. So, but this would basically leave SCO in a situation where their lawsuits against Sun and Microsoft are null and void, and Sun Microsoft can ignore them, and then SCO's got no more money, and the company's folding. That's the general feeling of people.
And another big thing here is that Novell can force SCO to pay them licensing dues for the money that they received from Microsoft and Sun.
To really punish
when
them.
When they were basically selling rights to use their property.
Well, thank you very much for the update on your former company and replace you formerly worked. Miles, I think I'll go to you, sir. Now that you've got a mic.
I've got a mic. And now I have a story. Here we go.
There we go.
There's a story in New Scientist about 8 million year old bacteria that's been thawed and made to grow again. This is bacteria that was found in the surface of a glacier in the Beacon and Mullen Valleys of of Antarctica.
Why are they doing this?
Well, they want to see how well that the DNA holds up over that amount of time. I mean, it isn't as
some
prolific.
Aggressive prehistoric bacteria is going to take over the world now.
Well, there's been some discussion I've seen about this story. It's an awesome story.
Well, there has been discussion about that, but at the same time, we don't get diseases from, there are things like rabies, but by and large, if a dog gets kennel cough, we don't get that cold because they're a cross species. The further they are from us, the less likely you have for infection. And this is an organism that is 8 million years old. It doesn't apply to probably just about any species on the planet anymore.
I don't want to test that. But
sure.
I'm assuming they're using good.
I'm sure they have containment facilities on it.
But they were able to bring it back to life.
Yes. They were able to thaw it and get it to start dividing again, which is really what bacteria does. Consumes and divides.
Right.
Sounds like the plot to a sci-fi flick from the future. Dun, dun, dun.
But they can watch and see like the amount of degradation that happens over a given period of time to DNA, and it has the great potential for figuring out how to how DNA does respond to that amount of time in frozen stasis.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you. We'll find out if it keeps on multiplying or if it gets deformed and weak and lame.
Apparently, but the half-life of bacteria DNA is 1.1 million years. After 1.1 million years, half the original DNA is degraded. So it was just a very robust bacteria that
can keep going. All right. Thank you very much, Miles, for that. Ryder? I'm sorry, Drew?
Good morning. All right. So kind of bringing us back in line with what our discussion is going to be today, Google's rolling out paid storage services, which is a little bit interesting because traditionally they've been giving away capacity as people grow their email boxes. And they've been the fastest donor of capacity or giver of free capacity, putting their competitors on alert. Normally, they add about 145 megabytes of free storage to each email account annually. When you think about all the Gmail accounts there are, that's a tremendous amount of capacity. But now they're going to start charging for people who are essentially extraordinary users. $20 for 6 gigabytes of online storage.
Is that a year or a month?
Annually.
Annually?
That's
okay.
Per year. So you can pay $20, get 6 gigs of online storage through Google, and you can put whatever you want there, of course. And as you look at Google's business model, they're expanding more and more. So you've got spreadsheets, you've got documents, you've got word processing stuff.
And you have just general files. I mean, there's upload tools that just put up files.
Exactly. But the files that are driving this capacity are things that Google tends to have their hands on, particularly mm-hmm. Picasa for pictures. So it's an interesting choice of them to get away from free storage and go towards charging for their
Well, I think it's interesting that they're doing 6 gigs. I mean, if you're doing your photo collection, that doesn't really touch it.
Hey, for only $75, you can put 25 gigs on. And for 100 gigabytes, you only have to pay $250.
So you can get...
You can go huge. They'll give... For $500, you can get 250
gigs. Okay, so they'll sell whatever you need.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good backup solution. And, of course, if you already have a Gmail account and having the account with Google, doing this is a really great way of doing backups.
Well, if you think about it, $2 a gig, so $500 for 250 gigabytes, $2 a gig is cheaper than you can get a hard drive typically.
That's true. And you've got complete redundancy,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. It's Google's managed by someone who we all believe is never going to let their data center go down.
Let's hope. Or at least lose their data.
We'll learn a little bit more about it today. Huh?
Yeah, we will. Okay, let's do the last news story with Sean, and then we'll get to Derek Wallace.
Oh, sure. Of course, we all know it, when you're driving, it's okay to text. You know,
No.
No, it's not?
I do it on the way here.
Actually, 9 out of 10 Americans say that should be banned, texting while driving.
How do you determine? Well, I love the idea in principle, but in execution?
I guess just like using a cell phone. If they ban that, why not? Texting. You can't have a computer in the front seat of your car.
In California. Yeah.
In California.
Cell phones, when you're talking on the phone, at least you can look at the road. With texting, you, by definition, have to look and see what you were typing in. So that's probably the biggest
I don't know. Concern. I know some college kids that don't have to look at their phone to text type stuff in, but, of course, to read it, they would.
Yeah, 91% of Americans believe that texting is like having a couple drinks.
You can stop anytime you want.
That. I mean, I could totally believe that. I mean, I could believe that with regard to cell phone conversations. Didn't they test that on MythBusters?
Yeah. It's
showing
it
was actually safer to have a couple of drinks than it was to use your cell phone.
So, nice. Washington, it's so far passed the first ban on texting while driving. 6 other states, including New York, California, and Florida, are also considering similar legislation. I do it. Not while I'm driving.
Do you text, Sean, specifically?
Well, my BlackBerry.
Yeah, right.
Text.
Email.
I have a hands-free in my Prius, you know, over Bluetooth on my cell phone. So I'm just talking while I'm driving that way. I don't think it's a big deal. But I only text it at stoplights when I'm waiting.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you're in stop traffic.
I never really text when I'm driving.
You're going non-lethal speeds.
You ever guys seen
I thought you were going to mention this story about the bus driver who racked up $34,000 of charges to the Metro department that he worked for because he was trying to enter a contest while he was driving the bus. So he sent them, and now probably he just sent the message over and over and got the thumb pattern down, but racked up a little more than I think they had a $5 plan, and he did $34,000. He lost his job. I thought that was a kind of interesting news story for texting and driving. Professional driver.
I didn't hear about
it.
That one. Interesting, yeah.
Right, are you going to say something?
I was going to say, have you guys ever seen people reading newspapers while they're driving?
I
mean,
this is
mm-hmm. you know, I correlate that to texting. I mean, it's just really bad.
If that isn't an argument for just expanded public transportation, so people on their way to work, they can work on this without any major problems.
You know, Ryder brings up that there is another story about newspapers. In that there's a new finding, there's a new report that shows that more people spend their time surfing the internet than reading newspapers or going to the movies or listening to recorded music.
Wow.
So now advertisers who are already spending $55.7 billion on newspaper advertising and $48.7 billion on broadcast television are now changing their demographics, and they think by 2011 they could be spending upwards of $63 billion just on internet advertising.
Wow. So it's a big business, this whole internet thing. Speaking of big business and internet, our guest today is Derek Weiss. He's the president and CEO of GNI, or Global Net Optics, Inc., and he joins us right now via phone, so you don't have to travel to us. Derek, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, guys.
I should say welcome back, and can you speak up a little bit, Derek?
Sure, I'll try.
Okay. So, Derek, you run data centers in San Jose and San Francisco and have a whole bunch of customers, and you provide bandwidth and other services. Can you give me kind of a rundown of what your clients are like?
We have a pretty wide range of clients, everyone from a single server and a single cabinet, just doing some hosting for either themselves or a small business, all the way up to some companies that let us talk about them, like HP, Symantec, and even some IBM sites that are hosted by us.
So some pretty large companies.
Everything from prestigious but small as GeekSpeak all the way up to HP.
Yeah, we should be pretty clear that you are a hosting provider.
Yeah, now you're kind of enticing me. You're saying some people that we can talk about. So you have a bunch of clients you can't talk about, apparently.
Oh, can you not hear? Oh, you know what? Sorry about that. He couldn't hear you.
I couldn't hear me. Oh,
all right. So go ahead and ask that question again, Miles.
You were saying earlier the customers that you can talk about. Apparently there are customers you can't talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. There's quite a few that that the data center craze kind of changed over time. Used to be enterprise companies would build and buy their own data centers, now it's really kind of moved towards a colocation model where they do trust someone else to service and operate those data centers for them. And not everyone advertises that very publicly, right?
They
now
want to feel like they're prestigious and that they have their own data center. So they try to hide that. Huh?
Tell us what colocation means, would you, Derek?
Sure. Colocation is basically like having a landlord and renting an apartment. So if you're going to go in and there's a fourplex, you're going to get one-fourth of the fourplex, and you're trusting someone else to make sure that the electrical is maintained, that the roof isn't leaky, and that the parking spaces are available, things like that. So colocation is similar to that, where the data center itself is owned by another real estate firm and operated by a management team. And then whatever you need inside that data center is provided to you on a monthly recurring basis, and typically you don't have any capital expenses to build or buy anything to operate or maintain the data center.
I'm familiar with your San Jose facility because that's actually where we have our server, and we go there sometimes when we need to work on it. What about your other facilities? Where are you right now?
So right now we're in 14 data centers worldwide. Have 7 in California. Anywhere between San Francisco, Sacramento, San Jose, Los Angeles, a couple of places in between. We're also in Arizona, Virginia, Frankfurt, Germany is our newest international site, and Tokyo.
Now, why is it important to have data centers all over the place? I mean, isn't the internet ubiquitous and you just put up one location? Couldn't you just put everything in that one location?
Not exactly. There's lots of different reasons. The primary realistic reason is for performance. The latency from here to Frankfurt, Germany is 150 to 200 milliseconds, which is not bad for sending email, but also if you're going to play Counter-Strike, it's not exactly a reasonable way to play a video game.
Do you host games?
Yeah, one of our largest verticals is we focus on the online game space, and we host about 15 online games today, and there's two or three of those that are pretty big, giant titles that you guys will see.
That you can't mention?
There's one that I can't mention. It actually, the press releases came out 3 days ago. A game called Hellgate London from Flagship Studios in San Francisco, California.
So, clarify for me. You guys have all the equipment, the air conditioning, the power, the plumbing, et cetera, the plenum, and these guys at Flagship Games call you up and say, hey, we want you to host all of our equipment and maintain all of our equipment, but we don't want you to look inside at what's going on the equipment?
Yeah, exactly. So, we become the operator for the physical infrastructure, and we usually stay out of the logical infrastructure. It's a little difficult. It's not so hard to manage someone's MySQL server. It's a lot more difficult to manage someone's custom developed application they built themselves. So we try and stay out of the application stack as much as we can.
All right. So one of the things that kind of brought up the idea of having you on is a couple weeks ago there was a power outage in San Francisco. What did it do to the internet?
If you read anything about it, it was pretty damaging. Some of the largest most popular sites on the internet are hosted at one of our data centers in San Francisco called 365 Main. There are a lot of things that I can't talk about. I just want to be upfront that there are a number of customers that are very private there, and there's some things I just won't be able to say. But I'll hint about what I can talk about. The data center itself lost power for about 45 minutes in the majority of the data center. Just about all the data center lost power for a few milliseconds, which is enough to restart anyone's server, basically.
Okay, are you the primary runner of that data center?
Well, we're contracted to operate the facility's network operations center. We're not part of the facilities team as far as generators or anything like that.
So you're not responsible for the power, but you're responsible for the customer's network. You know.
Yeah, basically we run the call center that's locally there, plus we have our own hosted services out of that data center.
So the customers,
we're kind of a vendor and a customer at the same time.
And so the customers that lost their services and started calling, they called your staff.
Exactly. So my staff is the one that ends up getting the phone call whenever the power's out.
So you had to turn around and call their facilities folks and say, hey, what happened? Where's the UPS? What's going on with the power?
Yeah, that was the exciting part. You know, cell phones start ringing all over the place because no one's landline.
Sounds like a pretty crazy day.
Man.
Yeah, it's not a fun thing to have a data center down. You know, we know it's $120 million of infrastructure investment in that data center, and that's not something you expect to have to see powered off.
Nope. And the stories I've heard about this are pretty clear that the power for the building was pretty redundant. You had like 8 generators, 2 of them were backup. They have flywheels so they can kick on automatically. There's an isolation using a physical isolation. Miles, you might really dig this. Have you heard this? So these generators, they've got these giant disks of mass that are spun by a motor that's powered by the electrical company, and it keeps it spinning. And when the power runs out, the sensing of how fast it's running shows that, oh, it's not on, so it turns on a diesel engine to turn that thing back on. But that spinning mass is a flywheel that actually stores electricity, if you can think of that, stores energy.
Energy, yeah.
So you have an isolation completely. That was a cool way of doing it. Makes a lot of sense. But what happened?
Very cool.
Why the even the millisecond dropout?
Well, it's extremely technical, so what I'd recommend is go to their website, 365main.com, and they have an update link on their website that talks about the specs. But in general, it came down to a software failure. There's, you know, like all things, there's some computer running it. And the computer that's running it had some sort of fragmented memory space that didn't allow the generators to start. So even though there are 10 2-megawatt generators on the roof in that M+2 capacity, which is, you know, for the generator failure, you could take one failure and have 2 backups. That's why there's 8 and 10 and 2 generator backups.
Mm-hmm.
4 out of the 10 generators failed. And so that's kind of where this is really, really scary for us. We're trying to figure out how, you know, $120 million worth of infrastructure can have a 40% failure rate.
Right.
And the thing is, though, I want to be careful not to blame 365 Main or on a competence standpoint, because if you look through the documentation, I've actually seen them do this. I've actually been on site during a month when they were doing run testing. But they actually run test the generators every week or every 2 weeks, and they actually do a full load bank test on the generators every month. The industry standard for this is they do a run test once a month, and you do a load bank test either quarterly or semi-annually. So they're way, way above the board on what they need to do. And there's lots of institutes that have come in and certified them and seen it. And it's not just BS on paper. You know, again, I've been in the building when they were doing it.
Yeah.
So it's hard to blame anyone, but it's also hard to be happy about you know, a failure with that many companies.
Okay, so I'm assuming that you've got some upset customers calling you, but you also have some solutions that have to do with even not even relying on one data center and possibly doing load balancing across multiple data centers. And I want to get into a little bit more of that and also about the legal issues of, like, there is money loss here and who's responsible kind of stuff. But we'll get to that in just a minute if you stick with us. GeekSpeak is supported by PreOwnedCar.com. PreOwnedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreOwnedCar.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We're now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. 476-2800, or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. That's 1-800-655-5877. And of course, if you'd ever like to ask us questions, you're welcome to do so by going to geekspeak.org. Stay tuned with KUSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on the Central Coast Public Radio. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I've got Miles, Drew, Ryder, and Sean. And we're talking with Derek Weiss. Derek Weiss is the CEO and president of NetOptics. He's Global NetOptics, or GNI for short. And he manages businesses or data centers all over the world. And we're talking about data centers, and it's basically the backbone of the internet. So, a pretty interesting topic for Geek Speak. You're welcome to call us, though, with any questions you have about technology in general, and we will take your calls. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. So, Derek, as we wait for calls, is there solutions that don't have to do with relying on the facility itself? Because, I mean, 40%, yeah, that's a really high failure rate, but it's always possible. So are some of the customers concerned, are thinking about it that in that way?
Yeah, there are a number of customers that came out of this. If you looked at what, there's a press release that came out 7 hours before the power failure from Red Envelope. And Red Envelope had posted a press release with 2 years of continuous uptime, and they consolidated their U.S.-wide data centers into 365 Main, and they were advertising how happy they were about it on the same day that the power went out. So
that's a lot embarrassing.
Of data, yeah, it's very embarrassing. Actually, the press releases had to come down the same day. There was if you Google it, you'll find out a lot of funny comments and interesting information about it. But in general, a lot of companies have moved towards looking for higher-end data centers and centralizing some of this management. The cost of doing this distributed over multiple data centers, over different disaster zone areas, means that it's really, really expensive for that internet traffic between the sites to synchronize data centers. And in our opinion, you know, in my opinion at least, the ability to do that seamlessly and fail over from one site to the other seamlessly is still dependent on things like DNS that is not great at propagating this kind of data efficiently.
So you wouldn't suggest this. So a company like, let's say, like an Amazon.com or something, their website really has to be at one data center?
No, I wouldn't recommend them being completely at one data center. I don't think a knee-jerk reaction to moving all sites, to 50 data centers in different regions all over the United States is reasonable. I think there should be a single disaster recovery site for reduced load or reduced performance.
Uh-huh.
But an N+2 kind of data center design where you have three data centers in the United States, one backing up the other, which is just about as safe a design as you can get, is also three times more expensive.
Sure.
And would probably drive a lot of companies out of business to attempt to deploy.
So this is really a question of how much downtime can you tolerate versus how much money do you have to invest?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the lessons learned from this were, from the companies that experienced this outage was quickly communicate with your customers what's going on honestly and very directly, and it was much easier to maintain it. The websites that put up, our websites under maintenance or we're doing a software upgrade, had a lot more fallout from this than the ones that said our data center is down on their website. So, people just want to be dealt with honestly, and I think you get a lot more, long-term customer respect and response from that kind of operation rather than trying to avoid the fact that there was a critical data center failure.
Now, is anyone calling you and saying, you know what, we really want to be in 365 Main because of all the data centers, that's probably going to be the most reliable for years at this point because of this failure? I mean, the redoubled of effort to make sure everything's secure seems like that's the place you want to be now.
Well, it was the funniest thing in the world. We were taking phone call after phone call of people screaming, justifiably so. And then I'm sitting there with my sales manager on the phone, and this guy calls and goes, hey, if anybody leaves, could you let us know because we're looking for space there? So it's still a high-end data center. We haven't lost an inch of square footage in net on the space. Everyone is still buying into it. It's just when you read through the whole chain of everything that happened, it looks almost unavoidable except for down to the hardware provider with buggy code. That's it.
So the other thing would be is if there would have been enough generators to have two providers of generators. So you have completely two different versions of generators on the roof.
And this is kind of the Alice in the rabbit hole kind of scenario. How far do you go? I mean, you have two different generators, but then you take two different brands of fuel pumps across those four different generators. And you can really go down to the point where this bolt was made in Antarctica and this bolt was made in China and hope that both of them don't fail simultaneously.
I see
the risk versus reward ratio like anything else.
I see that the 365 website's got a new LEED certified data center that they're seeking certification for. Mm-hmm. And LEED is the Leadership in Environmental and Electronic Design, I'm not sure, because energy design, yep, certification by the government. So are you getting requests by your end users to go into more environmentally friendly data centers? Are you getting pressure simply to reduce the amount of power consumption that's going on? I mean, this is slightly different than the uptime discussion, but still relevant.
Well, I would say we're not getting customers banging on our door saying, hey, it has to be in a green data center or else. But it is just an opportunity, I think, for the data centers to go out and do something that separates them from the rest of the pack.
Is differentiation worth any money in your business? I mean, you're selling trust, right? I mean, G&I is all about
trust. For me, green has very, very nominal value, say, for the customers that are really interested in it. What I like about this this idea with getting a green certified data center is if I have a customer that wants it, I can say yes. I have the opportunity to not say no to a customer.
Great. Derek, we're going to go ahead and take some calls from callers, probably off topic, but if you're welcome to chime in if you have some responses. From Santa Cruz, Leela joins us now. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. I've been trying to get DSL at my house, which is near downtown Santa Cruz, since about 2000.
That seems amazing. What's going on?
Well, I was told that I was too far away, and I live on Neary Lagoon on the downtown end, and mm-hmm. I'm surrounded by people in my condo complex who have DSL.
Ah.
And then they told me there were cables looped underground, and I'm going, well, that's your problem, not my problem. And then most recently, after receiving yet another ad from SBC and then AT&T offering me this service, I called and they went, well, but we're actually sold out your neighborhood.
Well, hang on a second.
You can never get it.
Are you in like a complex, like a condo complex?
I am, many of my neighbors have DSL, got it after I started trying to get it.
Okay, first off, go with a local ISP. Go with Cruise.io and try to talk to them. Have you talked to Cruise.io?
I did try to talk to them, and they weren't able to do it. This was 4 years ago.
Right. So I would do it more recently now and explain that you're getting ads for these other companies, which actually one company.
Well, it's just AT&T.
Yeah. And you want to go with local company. And that line, talking to them right off, will help you let them help you. I mean, they'll be much more interested in helping you. Now, the second thing is, it really could be your complex, and it's not the phone company's responsibility. It's very strange how that works with like that.
Others of my neighbors in the complex, like my next-door neighbor and the person right across the yard in the complex, have it.
Okay, so what I would do is go to your next-door neighbor and say, let's put in a wireless access point to your house, and then
exactly.
Let's just share your line, and we'll split the costs, and then you're getting internet for half the price, and DSL, the company doesn't get another purchase.
And your neighbor would have to pay half the price as well. That's what's in it for them.
So I would think about doing that. Use wireless to solve this problem. Don't even go with the company, you know?
The problem is that there's a specific amount of lines that can run from the central office, from the from the DSL company, and maybe those lines were already put in by the time you requested access, or maybe they run in weird paths underneath the building, throughout the building.
It's not
something that's likely to change unless you see workmen.
Yeah, and it's very likely that the hop that goes from the phone company box, wherever that is on the building, to your house is bad. And so when they test it, they're testing a trigger back from your phone's inductance.
Well, the person next to me in the same building got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's weird and flaky like that, and it's super frustrating.
But I would definitely go with this idea. If you've got a good relationship with that neighbor, you buy the wireless access point, unless they already have one. They might have one because DSL modems sometimes come with wireless access to them.
Okay.
And
so
just use that and just, get rid of the company completely in this.
So I've been looking on my Mac to see, because I think, like, my daughter's Dell before it died, you could tell that there was, what the names of the wireless people were. But how do I do that with a Mac?
Are you on a Macintosh laptop or a tower?
Laptop.
A laptop? Oh, well, then you have wireless most likely.
Right.
So you go into your internet. Miles, you want to search through what the preferences is for this? See if we can get to it. You go to System Preferences.
Okay.
And you go to Network. And then there's actually going to be a different box for Airport. And you can click Configure for Airport. Like right now it should say Location Automatic, and then under Show, do Network Status. Or you could just choose Airport.
Okay.
And then you do Options on your Airport. And one of the things on there is a little checkbox that says Show Airport Status in Menu. Go ahead and select that. And then up on the right-hand side, you'll see like a little, I don't know, four curves on top of each other getting smaller at the bottom, kind of like a piece of pie.
Right.
And then you're going to be able to see a whole bunch of networks by clicking on that. You just pick one of them. And the thing is, your neighbors probably have security enabled. So you need to talk to them and figure this out. And it's really about a relationship with your neighbor. Good luck.
Thank you. So there's there's no way to make the phone company provide the service that they advertise.
No, it's a monopoly. It's a regulated monopoly. Good luck.
I used to get those ads for the DSL up in Lompico, which you couldn't get DSL because technically it really was out of range, and I couldn't do anything about it. Now, there used to be like a little ISP that would offer DSL to you. You had to cover the costs of installation because they couldn't test the line. If one of those still exists, like you just say, you know what, install it and turn it on, I'm risking it, you can do that. And Brookdale's kind of like that. Sean has a decreased DSL service at his house because it's not as good. But there's enough customers complaining about it that they turned it on anyway with more tech calls probably.
High speeds are overrated.
Do you have a cable connection in your apartment?
I never watch television.
Yeah, it's too expensive to get cable without television.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at maybe Comcast, but the thing is I have got.net and they're local and they have great tech support and I really love them.
And they can't give you DSL?
They weren't able to do it. I mean, I can try again
and ask to talk to the president of the company. He's a really good guy.
I know. Well,
he's
when I tried it,
like,
I think back 2002, he wasn't.
Yeah,
it's
a new guy actually. So okay. Try it now.
Yeah.
And tell him that Lyle sent you over. Tell Don that Lyle sent you over from GeekSpeak.
There you go.
And that he needs to look into this.
That'll open any door for you.
Okay,
and tell him if
great.
He solves it, he can come on the show and talk about how he solved it. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks
good luck.
Bye bye.
Yeah, I'm moving to Comcast. Probably this next week.
Well, you know, why are you ditching DSL?
Well, you know what happened? A couple of years ago, SBC sent me this notice saying I could get extremely incredible speeds for half the price. And I jumped on it. And then they came back after they signed me up for a two-year contract and said, I'm sorry, we can't give you that speed in your area because you're too far away. Like, but you locked me into this contract.
And they sent a flyer to your physical address. They knew exactly where it was.
So I'm moving to Comcast. Yeah, Comcast is. I'm going to see speeds of 8 to 10 times better than what I'm getting now.
So, Derek, I'm assuming that the customers you deal with you don't have to worry about home wiring and all that stuff, right?
Not most of them, not in the Bay Area, at least in the downtown.
You don't run DSL as well, do you? Do you have dial-up?
No, we have a couple of clients that will do T circuits too. Just resold all the infrastructures. A lot of the guys will want to get a dedicated connection back into the data center space.
Okay, so you sell a dial-up kind of DSL solution for them?
No, just a T1.
Oh, a T1 directly,
too. Smallest thing that we sell right now.
Smallest thing he sells is a T1. Don't you love that kind of business? Sean, you got a question?
So, Derek, you run just all these data centers, and the stuff that you do is just so incredible. What's your background? How did you get into this?
I don't really have a background. It's kind of all over the place.
Uh-huh.
In 1976, when I was born, I'm just kidding, not that bad, but... I was in the Marines, so I did some telecommunications for the Marines for a while. I was actually at Enron Broadband Services and did field operations for those guys.
Did you have to be evil when you worked there? Or no?
I felt more evil when I worked there, yes. After they filed, I decided to take some control of my own destiny, start a company, and for the last 5.5 years I've been running GNI. That's where most of my real world experiences come from, the IP side. But you know, we're also smart. We hire good geeks. I'm only a miniature geek compared to some of the guys in our company.
Right. Surround yourself with really good geeks, you'll be okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I do the same thing here.
Derek, how do you keep your business? Like, where do you see yourself in 5 years as the value of data center becomes more and more commoditized? I mean, you're basing it on the service and that you're depending on other providers to make the uptime secure. What do you really have control over and where are you going to go with it?
Well, there's different kinds of leverage, and money is a big form of leverage. We're with companies like 365 Main, we're one of their largest single customers. So we can come in and we can scream and we can, you know, we can do things with money and threats that make people have to fix the problem. But it doesn't prevent the problem from happening, but it does help us, keep relationships reasonable by providing, points of leverage. There is no, definitive 100% guarantee on anything you do. So it is a risk. I'm not running a savings account when I start a company. I am running an investment. So we treat it like that. It is an investment. Does have risk associated with it.
Right.
But we minimize those risks by not being dependent on one data center. So for us, our 13, 14 worldwide data centers are across 6 different companies that operate data centers.
Do you leverage the different data centers with different customers, even if the customer like isn't being it is in a co-location? Are you offering services like SANS that does redundancy across data centers?
Yeah, exactly, and that's where we make some of the differences. So a number of our customers, we ask them in the Bay Area, we own our own 10 gig metro loops, and we're able to do things like say, hey, let's put your primary site here, your secondary site here. It's all on our same network, and should a system fail, you know, you can take the redundant site. We keep it really cost-effective for a customer to do this within our infrastructure versus them having to build it themselves at data centers they wouldn't be in with us.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. We have Ryder Brooks, Drew Meyer, Sean Cleveland, and Miles Elam. We're all talking with Derek Weiss about data centers. We're also taking your calls with questions and comments. And we have a question that came in during the – Miles, you want to take that question now?
This one came in during the Dr. Don show and wanted to address it here. It had to do with where to find information, having to do with medical issues.
So if I'm about to go into a surgery, like how do I find out if this what kind of
effects to expect? This one was talking about an arthritic spur, and it was saying, how do you find this information out on the net?
Yeah.
And Dr. Don put up a very good response, which was Yahoo Groups. It's a very good place to look. Google Groups, the same thing. They're both accessing the same repository of information, which is usually Usenet or Usenet repository. But what I find works the best is going to a search engine, such as Google, typing in the thing you're looking for, like arthritis, but don't just limit it to that. Because if you just put in a single word, you're going to get back a huge amount of ads.
And right, so you pain medication.
So you need to constrain it to say arthritis, spur removal, recovery. Mm-hmm. And put in all of those words together.
You can also think about, like, if you're looking for someone's story about how it went for them, think about how you might write that story and then put in phrases like that. Like, I went in for my arthritis spur removal. And you, like, kind of put that sentence in, and sometimes you'll get a story that's like that.
Right, or recovering from...
And the general idea is to hone your searching skills and to put in better searching criteria.
Right. You need to search in the same way that you either write or the types of things you see that are being written.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you.
That's what you said, Lyle.
That's a good thing, because I do not look for medical information online. I find it so frustrating to get this information that I happen to have a friend, Dr. Dawn, who I can ask questions of, and I just ask her. But it is a difficult thing to do. Drew, you had a question.
I wanted to make a correction to something that I said earlier, and thanks to Hal for pointing this out. The governing body for LEED certification is not the U.S. government. It's the U.S. Green Building Council, which is separate. Just making sure we're clear on what we said.
All right. Well, Derek, when you're doing the managed services, how much staff do you have at each of these locations? Do you have someone on 24/7 at the locations?
Yeah, all of our sites have to be – all of our 24/7 sites do require 24/7 on-site staffing. We have two or three different versions of that, depending on what the data centers want themselves and what our customers are demanding. But sites like 365 Main are what we call a double staff facility. There's about 20 employees that work there in 24/7 shifts all day, every day. And then we have the minimum we needed is sites somewhere between 8 or 9 people just to make the minimum number of hours work for 24/7.
Hey, in the storage business that I live and work in, I work for Network Appliance. We are hearing tremendous discussion about virtualization in the data center, where you can limit the amount of hardware platforms you have to run, one per server, and consolidate. So you save a lot of energy, you save a lot of space, you save a lot of cooling power costs. Is that something that's hot for you guys? Can you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, we treat virtualization a little differently. Whenever someone talks virtualization, they're talking about Xen or VMware and dividing up OSs. That's typically not what we look at, because we're... We host about 4,000 IBM high-density blade servers worldwide.
Tell us what a blade server is, would you?
So a blade server is basically, instead of a rack mount server, it's typically like 3 or 4 inches high and, you know, 30 inches long. We're looking at something that's about the size of a laptop that has basically the same components miniaturized inside of it. And in one cabinet, which is 7 foot high, 24 inches wide, instead of fitting a maximum of 40 servers in it, we fit 84 servers with dual quad-core processors, so 336 cores of CPU power in a single cabinet.
Okay, we're all drooling in here now.
Yeah, so you should come by and see it. It's nicknamed Darth Vader's bathroom. It's black. It's ominous.
Probably sounds like it, too.
No noise when you open the door.
Yeah.
But it's really, really super powerful, but it's also extremely expensive from a power consumption ratio. So normal cabinets, as data centers design them, are only really designed to do about 2,000 watts of power, which equals about maybe 16 amps at 100 volts or 110 volts.
Okay.
Which in today's, I mean, if you're doing like a Dell 2U server, that would mean maybe you get five or six servers in a cabinet. With this system, we're pulling about 12 to 13 times more power per cabinet than anyone else in the data center is doing on average.
Whoa. But the trade-off for you is that you can now put more people's stuff in that one cabinet
because you've
got more power.
There's
more
just efficiencies out of scale. So the bigger you make something, I watch Discovery Channel sometimes for entertainment, and the biggest machine in the world is like a paper mill in Slovakia or something. And the bigger the paper mill is, the more efficient it is. It's the same way with power and with density. The larger the power distribution system that plugs into my cabinet, the more efficient the power is itself because of the conversion ratios on the voltage. But also, the more efficiently I can use it. I'm drinking out of a giant fire hose instead of little tiny straws that I may not be getting 100% efficiency out of all over the place.
Now, what about the cooling costs that go along with Darth Vader's bathroom?
Well, the cooling costs are similar to what it would cost. So we're running 840 blades in San Francisco at 365 Main. These 840 blades take up the space of 14 cabinets. Now, we can do this same environment with 1U pizza box, you know, the really like a super micro or a regular cheapo type server, but it would take us 100 to 120 cabinets to do it. And so we use the same amount of space. We use the same amount of power. Our heat impact is only trivially less, but we get a lot of efficiencies from the operational standpoint. But we also do get some power efficiencies by not running quite so many fans.
So you're saying that you're not producing that much more energy from this high-density cabinet setup?
Actually, I'm saying we're producing less energy on net than the equivalent low-density cabinets that it would take to do this.
Gotcha.
Okay.
But isn't it, since it's more concentrated, aren't you trying to cool those racks?
We leave ambient space for it.
You'll
see a big black cabinet in the middle of a giant empty space.
Cool.
And the difference is that big black cabinet has better, the parts in there happen to be better capacitors, fewer fans or larger fans.
Right.
Larger
efficiency.
Power distribution. So these, you manage the macro by the micro on these kind of environments. 1% of efficiency is thousands of dollars a month of cash to the bottom line.
So
we're talking thousands of servers.
Derek.
There's one thing we're forgetting about blades. What happens when one fails?
It's one inside of a chassis environment. It fails. We roll over to another one that's either hot spare or cold spare in the environment.
How do you do that without virtualization?
It's a little different. It's basically, if any of you guys are Linux geeks, you know what PXE boot and kickstart environments are like.
Mm-hmm.
We pre-build environments with customer images that are based on backup databases.
Gotcha.
And, you'll be happy with this from the NetApp side. We do a lot of SAN and NAS storage to keep their environment and their data structures off of the blade servers.
Uh-huh. Sure. So the blade server is just a hardware that's mounting data from its SAN's
processing power.
The operating system and the RAM. And
okay.
We can replace their compute operating systems and RAM at any time.
For the sake of our audience, just because it's an interesting topic, do you want to describe what a PXE boot is?
Yeah, sure. PXE boot is basically a way for a server, basically a distribution of the operation of the operating system can be stored in a centralized location. And with a single command, that server can be located, started, the operating system installed, rebooted, and delivered to the customer, completely configured the way it needs to be, in less than a few minutes, rather than having to manually do any work at all.
Yeah, all remotely. In other words, you're not
all
at
remotely.
The box.
Yeah. My engineers that actually do this work, there's only about seven guys running 4,000 servers worldwide.
So I recently saw a little lecture at UCSC, which is where I work, and they're doing a data center with, I don't know, 12 machines that have multiple virtuals running on each of them. And the virtuals are stored on a SANs, and when one of the hardware goes down, a different hardware takes over for the virtuals that the other one was hosting. And it's all this, VMware kind of solution, which I see the redundancy and everything. So what you're saying is basically, instead of doing it that way, you just, you're taking the operating systems and you're making sure that at any point one of them can completely die. Another operating system could start up, and the data that the first one was accessing is still being accessed from the database. So you're not really dealing with any data loss, and you're actually dealing with a different operating system starting up.
Yeah, and that we are doing it differently, but I wouldn't say instead of it quite so much. The reason we're not doing VMware is because VMware is specifically good for low-performance applications or for shared resources like CPU. But when you think about things that we're doing, like hosting online video games, these guys are crushing 100% CPU all day long, so dividing their CPU in half
doesn't help.
The server on it is not effective. So they need the whole CPU. So we can't really virtualize the hardware when someone needs 100% of the hardware.
There's a bigger picture concept that I hear you talking about here, which is separating the server processing power from the storage location. Yeah. Is that pretty much accurate? So you can deal now with operating systems and processors completely independently from the attached storage where all the data is, and you can modify either one of those independently?
Exactly. Today we run about a quarter of a petabyte of SAN storage, and that's specifically to hold the data for our customers that are hosting our Blade systems.
And is that, so those customers all have different, you know, I'm going to get some real geeky terms here, but bear with me. They have different LUNs on the SAN?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, different LUNs on the SAN, different connections. We do separate things logically and physically for the customers to make sure that they have the performance they need on their disk. And so it's a lot of custom design that goes into this.
That's my question, so that I don't end up sharing my storage space with some other guy who I've never met.
The last thing that you want to do is try to back up your files and then someone else is backing up at the same time. You've missed your IOPS. We're really getting kind of overboard on the geek terms here.
Yeah, I think it's great.
There's a lot of knobs to turn to make all this stuff work right, huh?
Yeah, it's extremely expensive and extremely complicated, but in the event of a failure or a catastrophe, we're actually also taking this data that they put on the SAN storage and replicating it to other SAN storages in metro area loops so that in the event that there is an issue, we could just pop up a server at another site and give them access to the data sets again.
Disaster recovery. I love it. Is there any tape involved anywhere? Is anybody backing off the tape?
We absolutely, positively refuse to use tape, and we turned away customers that required it.
Are there contracts and such that require them? Like, so that's why the customer
needed
it?
Yeah, we've had customers that have come in and said, hey, we need to ship our tapes off-site, and we quickly remind them that we can ship them a perpendicular SATA drive with 750 gigs of storage on it, but we just won't ship them a tape drive. They're more expensive to operate in the long term, and also backups are only as good as recovery times. If you think about shipping your tape to Iron Mountain for off-site storage, the 2 days it takes to Iron Mountain to get it back to you and then start recovering from tape, it's no longer worth the backup itself.
Derek, so I want to
say... very particular about that.
Derek, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today on GeekSpeak. I really appreciate it.
Cool.
I'll talk to you real soon, okay?
All right, take care, guys.
Take care.
Thanks, Derek. That was
very
great.
Good show.
GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. The geeks this morning were Drew Meyer, Ryder Brooks, Miles Elam, and Sean Cleveland. Geeks, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Alex backing us up on AIM, Rick answering phones. Our guest today was Derek Weiss. He runs GNIHosting.com, which also is our hosting provider, and we thank him for doing both that and coming on the show and sharing his expertise. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and he's used by permission. The GeekSpeak podcast is supported by PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available online at PreownedCar.com. For KOSB and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Thanks for listening.